Okay.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Cambridge Inside Out. My name is Robert Winters.
Judy Nathans.
And today's August 2nd, 2022. Sometimes I make a pronouncement of the date and get the date wrong because I'm pathetic sometimes. But today I got it right.
Because? And,
part of the reason is this would have been my father was born 105 years ago today.
Oh, wow.
He's been gone for 30 years, but the thing is that August 2nd, whenever it comes around, uh-huh. I just always sort of give a tip of the hat to Ed Winters, you know?
Yeah, your father and I are probably about the same age.
No. That would make you 105 years old, Judy. So
no. I said your father. Oh, that you're right. Your father right. And my father. Excuse
that,
me.
Okay, that's right. That's
1920
right.
1920 was my father's birth year.
Yeah, yeah.
Yours was probably 2019.
So anyway, you know, a tip of the hat and an acknowledgement of the, as I like to say, the relentless passage of time. You know, it's true. It's true.
And you're carrying on the name.
Yeah, that's it. So anyway, we are kind of midsummer, you know, and I would say from a city point of view, you know, for reasons that I actually don't know where the tradition began, but for as long as I can remember, Cambridge City Council and really school committee as mm-hmm. well pretty much takes off the summer. You know, so
well,
they'll
they
have
need a break. Why not?
No, I absolutely agree. I mean, the scheduling has always been a bit of a mystery to me about exactly why. Yeah. But so what they do is they go through June, and then they stop, July. And then they
go through June, right? Yeah.
And I suppose technically, in terms of regularly scheduled meetings, they don't return until after Labor Day or thereabouts in September. But they always hold what they call a special meeting.
Yeah.
In August 2nd, which is indistinguishable from a regular meeting. And it's often one of the meetings of the year because there's so many weeks before it and so many weeks will be afterwards until the next, that it tends to have very large agendas, you know.
But there have been committee meetings in between. It's not that they're not meeting. Yeah.
Well, actually, I was sitting with Tim Toomey and Denise Simmons at a gala.
Yeah.
This past Friday, you know, for Louis DePasquale, and Tim asked me, he said, so you got one of those gigantic agendas with 104 resolutions, you know, 150 resolutions on it. And I said, actually, no, it's pretty reasonable. I think it was only about 44 resolutions and I think something like 16 or 17 city council orders, which, you know, actually it was kind of pleasant. Sometimes these things you'll get like if there's a controversial issue and sometimes there are big controversies that are happening on the summer meeting because somebody tried to rush something really big through in June and then it got kind of punted and then everybody brings out the troops for the summer meeting.
There was only 13 public commenters.
No, actually it was like, you know, peace and love. I mean, there was not a whole lot going down. You know, so that was okay for me. And you know, I wasn't eager to sort of digest a whole lot of controversy or anything.
There were more city manager agenda items, or about 20.
Yeah, you know, I think it may also be somewhat attributable to the fact that we are basically in this sort of this interim period.
Right, so there's things between, still happen, right, yeah.
Yeah, I think actually last night's city council meeting was the first one where our new city clerk, Diane LeBlanc, actually officiating.
Right. Yes.
And actually, I had a little bit of an interaction with her beforehand because there was an agenda item. This is sort of small matter, really, but it was for signage for the new Tasty Burger that's going to be opening on Prospect Street in Central Square.
I'm excited by that.
I actually am too. It's in the space that used to be occupied by CCTV once upon a time.
So that's, I was wondering, because it was confusing by like what you said, the address.
The petitioners or the lawyer for the petitioners had must have put in something like their address accidentally. And they notified the abutters of 353 Prospect Street in Inman Square about the fact that there's a Tasty Burger coming. So I didn't actually think about it at the time, but when I alerted her to the fact that there was, and the city councilors, the fact that no, it's actually right in Central Square. I didn't realize at the time that meant that also that they had notified all of the wrong abutters.
Oh, no.
and that consequently they couldn't actually act on it. So it's right, for that reason that matter, they had to table it. Certainly wasn't my intention to force that to be tabled, because we want them to move forward. You know, everybody in Central Square
we've been
wants,
dying to have a, I mean, I know they sell hot dogs. It's not purely hot dogs, but they
it's the kind of place we need more of, you know, and I think it'd be great. You know, we'll have the diner on one side of the street and the Tasty Burger on the other side of the street.
I think I'll frequent the Tasty Burger.
Right. But anyway, it was the minor matter, but I did have I got a nice thank you from the city clerk for alerting to the issue. Yeah. And then they dealt with it appropriately. It was really,
what would we do without you, Robert?
People would do just fine. I'm sure, actually.
I don't know.
But the fact is that this really is, we are in the sort of a betweener. This was the one city council meeting when Owen O'Riordan, as acting city manager, gets to actually act as city manager at a public meeting. I mean, he's been carrying out the job of the city manager ever since he was put into the position. Labor Day.
When is the first city council? September 12th or something?
Something about that. And Yan Huang will be city manager when that comes around, I believe.
So that'll
September,
be his first meeting.
September 6th is his first day on the job, but then his first position.
Labor Day is on a Monday, so they can't have it.
Yeah, I am going to point out, though, that while I was enjoying a couple of India Pale Ales, Wendell's yesterday afternoon, I espied across Winthrop Park, sitting on a park bench, I said, there's a gentleman who looks awfully familiar. I realized it was our new city manager, and he was waiting to meet with somebody. So he went into the Pete's Coffee to meet with some bigwig, whatever. I've actually been hearing tales from people in the fire department and elsewhere of he's been meeting with people and asking the right questions, and apparently, you know, proving himself to be a pretty good study. You know, when you're meeting with somebody from the fire department, and the new city manager will actually start speaking about things that happened 18 years ago, I said, this is a guy that does his homework. So I thought that was pretty impressive. So I'm actually feeling pretty optimistic that this can work out pretty well. I also heard that there was an ad, they put out the public advertisement. I haven't seen it yet for, I don't know, are they going to maybe restructure things a little? You know, we've always had city manager, deputy city manager.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What's happening with that?
So there's an advertisement for like a chief of staff position, which has never actually existed.
Oh,
yeah.
But wait, doesn't the mayor have a chief of staff?
I mean, that actually began when somebody I knew became chief of staff under Sheila Russell. And that position didn't exist before that either.
Okay.
You know, it's just a name, really. But, you know, it suggests, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, okay, so are we going to have a chief of staff and a deputy city manager?
Or are we going to have aren't those different functions, though? I mean, I see a deputy city more like a vice president versus a chief of staff, which sort of oversees the schedule and stuff like
It depends on how the manager wants to set up the organization, basically. Okay. So we'll see.
Do you think he asked for this position? Do you think that's how he wants to operate?
Right. Yeah, but what it actually means, I don't know yet. But
so there may not be a deputy system.
You know, the deputy city manager, like when Richie Rossi was he was Bob. You know, when there were like major projects going on around town, Bob Healy wasn't going to sort of be like the man with the hand on the tiller.
That's right. So,
the deputy city manager was sort of a. He was typically was a little closer to the individual departments. I think Richie actually even stepped in as may have actually been sort of heading public works at one time, you know, because that's going the role through, step into as a deputy city manager.
I see.
You know, so but, you know, things do not have to be as they were, you know, things can.
I could see them maybe not. I don't know. I mean, it depends how hands-on the Ian wants to be. Maybe he wants to be more involved, therefore the chief of staff would help him versus the deputies.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see,
It may be indicative of just the fact that this is a fundamentally big change in, you know, from status quo. Not somebody who graduated up through the ranks. It's actually somebody legitimately coming from the outside.
So, well, why do you say that? Couldn't somebody that's within apply for it?
No, I'm talking about the city manager. The city manager did not come up through the ranks.
I thought you meant how they're advertising.
No. It's open to anybody who wants to apply for it.
Right.
Well, if you're interested, Judy, it's
Sure. Yeah. I'm sure you really want to get involved.
You have all the qualifications necessary.
I doubt it. I doubt it very much. I'm not very diplomatic at all.
Nor am I, actually. So, anyway,
I don't even shake people's hands these days. I wear a mask, so I don't think I'd fit.
But we are definitely in sort of the betweener. So this was Owen's one meeting as last night as city manager.
Yeah.
And the next one will be the next full-time city manager.
It's kind of exciting.
It was the first meeting for the new city clerk, who I thought handled this quite well.
Yes.
It's for this reason. I think maybe the city councilors are holding back a little bit.
That's a good point. Nothing too controversial. Let's wait till we.
It would be kind of rude to sort of drop a bomb right in the lap of a new city manager. Honestly.
Yeah, exactly.
I said, let's ease them in a little bit here, and we'll see how that goes, Anyway, speaking of transitions, this would be a good time to just mention it. One of our, the paper of record for the thing is that if you want to find out something over the historical record going back to the beginning of the city of Cambridge in 1846, you will go to the paper of record, which is the Cambridge Chronicle,
and things are still published in there, like legal notices,
etc. Yes. It is it's really the paper of general circulation
in that
case.
I agree with you,
right? There, so, I'm definitely a fundamental believer that it's a good thing for any city to have kind of a long-standing paper of record.
You should have a local news source.
Right. But,
you and some other people.
But, we have, ever since the days of Elliot Spalding being the longtime editor of the Cambridge Chronicle, and then it was under Dole Publications, I believe. And then nowadays it's under Gannett.
Happening all over the country. Yeah.
Yeah. There is a fundamental problem with the survivability of the local papers that are, part of like more of a traditional press type of setting. And, to make the long story short, so Will Dowd, who's really a fine fellow, who took over as editor last year after Amy Salzman left the paper. And I thought he's been doing a commendable job, getting to know a lot of people, really, really putting a great effort into it. But this past week was his last week with the Cambridge Chronicle. And he has moved on to a new nonprofit journalistic effort in Marblehead. And I think it's Marblehead's gain, our loss, really, quite honestly. Yes. It sort of brings back echoes of Amy Salzman leaving a year ago. Mm-hmm. And really, it's sort of if you like me, have some kind of belief in having a paper that is a full service paper, running from the obituaries to sports coverage to, to legal notices to everything.
I don't know. With the money for that then.
All right, but I have access to the historical record of Cambridge Chronicles, and they used to do all of that, mm-hmm. and then some.
Well, of course, I could point to a million places around the country.
Right,
where
they had very extensive op-ed, so there were a lot of contributors putting into it, and over the years things have sort of been dying on the vine, and in no small part,
the internet has influenced that a lot. Blogs and people having their own sites. You have a site, Cambridge.
Right.
I'm not saying they replace it, but that is a lot to do with it.
I'm simply pointing out that many places, both large and small, mm-hmm. have adapted to the internet world so that they have an online presence. They also have a print presence. Mm-hmm. And honestly, even if the Cambridge Chronicle were continued only as an electronic presence, which would not be my choice, even that would be something of some value. But the problem is, as Dan Kennedy and many other wise people have pointed out, is that when you've got this sort of the mega ownership of sort of big chains, to do that is that it doesn't always translate into the necessary resources for the reporters and editors down at the local level. You know, in my view, that should change. I don't know how you make that change, but it really should change.
You have to change the structure, the way we do business right. in this country and capitalism and all that stuff.
Right. I mean, but you know, as I, you know, regretfully always point out, people like me who try and contribute to the local newscape to some degree, mm-hmm. you know, we're kind of ephemeral in a way, you know, we come and go.
Well, you're not in paper. You come and go, but you've been around.
To whatever degree, I basically archive things that I've gathered up. I mean, even the Cambridge Public Library has asked me to basically provide archives and things, so there is a record of some sort, mm-hmm. so people can look things up, you know, many, many, many years from now.
Yeah.
You know, but it is just the nature of the kind of the bloggy kind of world. It is a little bit like ice sculpture. You know, it might be wonderful while it's there, but it after a while, it's just basically a puddle of water for future generations, unless you take great steps to make it otherwise.
What do you think of the Boston Globe?
You know, Boston Globe and the New York Times both they have managed to adapt in ways that I think maybe you have to be of a certain scale with a certain reach. And then you can basically pull off the simultaneous provision of both print and electronic media. You know, you need an organization, it's true.
Yeah. You need John Henry. Yeah.
And you have to have enough to appeal to actually keep a readership, which they've somehow managed to do in this, you know, in the electronic, you know, paywall.
Well, I have a digital membership, but I have to say I don't really read the way I used to with a paper copy because I can't get a paper one.
No,
I will support it though.
I'm not sure if I'm going to be resubscribing to the Cambridge Chronicle paper version because the delivery is not the best.
I've heard, but no, I pick it up for free at the library.
But the truth is I do probably access, not probably, I definitely access it more electronically than I do on paper anyway. And I don't think, I think that's probably sort of going to be that way forevermore, but still kind of nice if there was at least some sort of nominal paper printing as well as a lot of these things here, for eternity in a way, you know, but anyway, I just thought it was noteworthy and my understanding is.
So what's going to happen?
Well, I believe that the company will be assigning somebody to, at least temporarily, and then, you know, but the difficulty is it unless you actually have lived in a city like Cambridge for a good long while, it takes a while to sort of get to know who the players are, to be able to filter out the bull crap from the real, you know, because honestly, you know, if you're a new person who shows up as an editor of paper, mm-hmm. you're probably going to get called up by all the activists who are going to try to tell you their piece of truth, which might not be truth at all.
Right.
And, you know, so you have to acclimate to the position and it takes some time. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a sort of a shame, you know, for those of us who just want to see, you know, facts put out there, you know, and stories of interest actually being, you know, spread more widely. That somebody should actually have some instant memory.
Speaking of that, did you see the last issue? They had like two full pages of this property at 8 Island Avenue, the $7 million property. I mean, really?
Well,
somebody paid for that. And it wasn't one of these ad kind of, you know, editorial things. It was like article.
Yeah, but some things are actually. They may not look like advertisements that they are.
No, I know that it's called an ad. I know it's like a combination, but this seemed, it was front page and then it continued on another page. And I just thought, wow, something's not right here.
But you know, something, it's interesting. If you actually go back, you know, either on the old microfilm or you can actually through the Cambridge Public Library,
I've done that to find stuff that when I was actually in the paper.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a 50-year blackout period. But if you sign up with the Cambridge Public Library to edit and do some, you know, they have like optical character recognition, but there are errors.
Yes.
And if you're willing to sort of occasionally just go in there and help out to correct that, make corrections, they'll give you access to the full range of Cambridge Chronicle and other Cambridge newspapers that are long gone. to do that. It's very helpful for me. I can actually find information, you know, from the 1930s and 1940s and things. And it's really handy, you know, to be able to do that. But the point I was going to make was that if you look at those old papers, a lot of them were largely advertising. You know, if you look at old newspapers, it's, it typically was more like little boxy ads for cleaners and, you know, shoemakers.
No, they make it sound like it's a special press piece, but it's actually an advertisement because they get money for it.
Yeah, so I mean, newspapers
been going on for a long time.
Yeah, oh yeah, for hundreds of years. Yeah, like newspapers always had a lot of advertising in there. So that doesn't bother me. But, you know, you want to have at least a certain amount of heft, which includes things like letters to the editor and opinion pieces by other authors.
I haven't seen any letters to the editor in the print version.
I don't think they're encouraging it. They haven't even been interested in it. And that's a company decision.
I know.
You know, but you know, there was some real famed, really great characters who used to do regular columns for the Chronicle over the years. You know. Yeah. And, you know, I kind of miss that. And, you know, the question then is how much of this is revivable and how much of this is just sort of just going to become a historical relic? I mean, I actually think, and, you know, Dan Kennedy, you know, who teaches at Northeastern, and you may see him on WGBH with some regularity. Dan will, you know, I think he makes a strong case for nonprofit entities actually getting, you know, sort of orchestrating local journalism.
That's happening. Ways. It's happening around the country.
It is happening, but I actually asked Dan, I said, do you know of any examples of like a big company like Gannett basically peeling off something like Cambridge Chronicle and sort of putting it back into the hands of a more local nonprofit type of entity? And there aren't that many examples, but there are
not
some.
Not that example. I meant just starting without that big entity, but.
I agree, but the thing is, you know, there is a certain kind of cachet of being sort of an established news vehicle, even if it changes hands. And even something like the Cambridge Chronicle has changed hands over the years. Yeah. So, you know, what'll be the next iteration of that? I don't know, you know, but
they have a lot of wealth in this community. You think somebody could start a foundation or something? And
But you know, it's more than money. You also have to have a kind of that intense desire to.
Think you would have that in the city of so many.
You know, you would think so, but you know, I've often pointed out, I think I said this at some conference one time about local journalism, probably 20 years ago. I said, you know, there's actually a fundamental problem being a biggish city on the shoulder of a bigger city.
Good point.
You know, if you're in Boston, you're going to have things like the Boston Globe, the Boston Herald will cover your news. If you're in Framingham, you probably have a local paper. That many people, maybe most people in Framingham will read.
You know, my daughter just subscribed to the Cape Cod Times because she has a house there, and I think they publish daily.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where their stuff comes from. But, so you know, there is a whole Cape. Yeah.
There is a survivability that is possible if you're sort of in a major market, running a major market, or running a very minor market.
Yes.
But it is a fundamental problem when you are, as I like to say, a modestly large city on the shoulder of a bigger city, where you end up being just in the shadow of Boston. And, you know, and many a Cambridge resident probably, if they're going to subscribe to any paper, they're probably getting the Boston paper or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or something like that, you know?
Right. But you know what? I would subscribe to the Chronicle if it was worth it. But if I can pick it up for free, I'll do that. That's what I do. So.
Yeah. But, you know, there was a time Cambridge Chronicle would have a circulation of 24,000.
I know. People. I think I was subscribing years ago.
24,000 households, and the households were larger. So half the people in the city would be accessing it regularly.
No, I know. When it was owned by this person you mentioned, I think.
Yeah, well, when Elliot Spaulding was like the editor, and you know, and it was really solid.
Like 20 years ago or something,
So again, and I don't mean to be in any way generating any efforts from other people, but including myself here, but the thing is that-
Or CCTV.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. You know, I think
and
we all have to play-
WBUR covers some local stuff. I mean, it's online, and if you're not an online person,
you know, but again, I would be happier if we also sort of could.
I do.
Assure
there's anybody
the
out there, some entity,
consider. Let's talk. Let's see what can happen
let's
here.
Let's talk. Okay.
So we're gonna take a break in a few minutes here, but I would just maybe I'll mention here that yesterday we talked a little bit about what City Council was up to.
That was a special meeting.
But I think I might want to just mention here right now that this past weekend was the Cambridge Jazz Festival, and yes. I was there. I saw you there on Saturday.
Yes.
And I was back there on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
Included one a really a tribute to Aretha Franklin, which was absolutely dazzling.
Oh, that's nice.
And followed by a woman who's actually, I think she teaches at Berkeley, who is a violinist doing in a jazz band. Her name is Chelsea Green. And her group is called the Green Project, and it was absolutely fabulous.
Great.
You know, I had a kind of a little bit of a connection to the jazz festival only because my neighbor, Larry Ward, who's two doors away from
founder,
me, he's a founder, principal organizer of it. Mm-hmm. And my downstairs tenants were all completely involved in all of the,
oh, right.
of the heavy lifting of actually making it work.
Yeah.
And even last evening, right at the corner of my house, it was like the whole Cambridge Jazz Festival. We were having like a little sort of, you know, food and drink thing right here at the street corner, you know. So it's sort of been, for me, it's been like 4 days of Cambridge Jazz Festival in one form or another. And it was great. And, you know, the drought has been pretty brutal. And
mentioned today, actually, the festival and the drought on it.
Yeah.
It was the local VUR, and they said everybody had to sit on the sides. They were talking about the absence of trees.
People were definitely seeking refuge. They went back onto the grass, but problem was is that this year the drought has basically turned the grass into basically a dead
brown
carpet.
Yeah, but there's still, but even so, in the sun, I was there whenever they last had it, and it's still too hot. There's no shade.
Yeah.
Unless they have some kind of tent system, it's very hard to really be in front of that stage.
Green grass would have been helpful though. So
not in the sun. Sorry. Yeah. I disagree with you.
No. I've been there times when it was in the green grass and it was great. So
well, that's you. Most people can't sit in the sun like that.
All right. So anyway, we're gonna take our traditional 3 minute break.
Oh, right. See you in the next segment.
So we'll be back in a minute on Cambridge Inside Out.
Okay.